The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening and welcome back to the sixth and final evening of our introduction to mindfulness meditation. And as we have in the past, it's nice, I think, to begin informally with some questions if you have any, and what we've done so far, your experience of meditating at home. And then as people are more settled coming in, we could I'll give the instructions for today. Any questions you might have?
So my question is, you've talked about how meditation, there's no expectation of an outcome when you practice meditation. But yet I've heard people say that they may have an issue in their life, some problem or something they need to explore, and they'll say, I need to meditate on that. Maybe someone who has more experience with the practice than I do. So how does that lay out? Okay. I'm hearing no expectation, but I'm hearing people say I need to meditate on a specific issue, so I'm a bit confused.
Yeah, so you're bringing together a lot of different ideas. So we need to tease apart some of your different ideas. So it can be fairly common in meditation circles, in our circles sometimes. People say meditate without any expectation. And sometimes they'll say even meditate without a goal. I think it's, but of course there's an expectation, and of course there's a goal. The goal and expectation of meditation is it's going to help us be free of suffering, to be able to be more peaceful, have more insight, more understanding of our life, what's going on. And so that it's fine to have that. However, it's very easy for that to be transformed into a certain kind of a demanding expectation, or expecting expectation, or a goal that we begin striving after, pushing for, a goal that we start measuring, how am I doing, measuring up, or a goal that we say, I can never do that. And it's very common to hold expectations and hold goals in ways that are counterproductive for the process of meditation. So it's fine like to have a goal of becoming more peaceful, or a goal to be more, resolve issues in your life. When you sit down to meditate, while you're meditating, it's best to put those goals aside. The goals got you to the cushion. But once you're there, put the expectations, put the goals aside, and just really focus on being fully present for this experience now. Because if you're focusing on the goal or expectation, then you're focusing on something which is not happening. You know, some abstraction, idea in the future. And so you're missing what's happening now. And the key aspect of this kind of meditation we're doing here is to be mindful of what's actually happening, not be mindful of what you hope is going to happen. Okay, make sense? So that's one half. The other half of what your question has to do with the phrase, meditate on something. And that's a colloquial expression that uses the word meditation very differently than how we would use it. So I think generally when people say that, they mean to spend some time thinking about it, or thinking about it in a kind of more focused, concentrated way than you normally would, kind of contemplate it in some deeper way. But generally, when people use that word, that expression, they mean to think about it. When we're doing mindfulness meditation, we're not trying to think about our issues and trying to resolve them through a thinking mind, analyzing them, planning out, trying to understand what's really happened in that situation. So for example, if you have a problem at work, something you need to think about and try to resolve, that's an important thing to do. You might go for a walk, you might talk to a friend, you might sit and have a cup of tea and think about it or something, and that's a useful thing to do. But when you sit down to meditate, do this mindfulness meditation here, you wouldn't use that time as a time to contemplate, to think about the problem at work. If the problem at work keeps popping up while you're meditating, which it might, thoughts keep happening, what we would do is we would bring mindfulness to what's happening here and now. Here and now, there's a mind that's thinking. Here and now, there's a body, a heart, that has anxiety around this issue. And so we bring very careful mindfulness to here and now, the experience right now. Like 2 weeks ago, we talked about mindfulness of thinking, where it's just to step back and look at your thinking. Don't be involved in your thinking. Does it make sense? So when we talk about meditation in these circles here, we're talking about something different than that colloquial expression. Now, you know, so it's very interesting that you might have a problem at work, and so if you think about it, you might come to some practical solutions to it, maybe, ideally. But it's at the level of the problem itself. If you sit and meditate, so if the thoughts about the issue at work keep bubbling up in meditation, and rather than thinking about it, you really bring your mindfulness to really be present for the present moment experience of thinking about what's like to thinking about it at work, what the feelings and emotions are, then you might actually go deeper and drop below the level of the actual problem itself to the deeper underlying issues in your life around, emotional issues, different kinds of issues that are maybe the ground out of which the problem at work begins. So just to make a situation up, it could be that a person has identity issues about always needing to be liked by people, and someone at work doesn't like you. So you might spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, how am I make this person like me? And if I buy the person a gift, then the person will like me. So, okay, that problem is solved. And in fact, because of that, the person does like you. So problem solved. Great. If you sit and meditate, and you're sitting there meditating, trying to be present, and this thoughts about this person doesn't like me, this thought, what should I do about this, keep popping up, then in mindfulness meditation, you would not think about it. You turn around and look at this phenomena of just experience of thinking going on. This is what's happening. This is a present moment experience. You step out of it and look back at it in a sense. And you might become aware that underneath, you know, this desire to solve this problem is an underlying issue of anxiety around not being respected. And so then you look at that underlying anxiety and you sit there and really feel your way, again, not to solve it, not to analyze it, not to do therapy with it, but just be fully present. And then something very interesting begins happening where we start dropping into deeper kind of wellsprings of what's going on, what motivates in our life, that might actually have much more lasting benefit for you than figuring out that I should have given the guy a gift. Does it make some sense? And we don't go digging, but with mindfulness meditation, we're really present. We try to be still and very present for this experience. And then as we're really present for as it is, it begins to show itself to us more fully. And we realize there's lots going on here. I didn't realize how much is going on. And some of it represents some of the depths of the operating principles that drive us, sometimes unconsciously. That was a long answer. Other questions? Do I dare ask?
Well, I have a background. I'm a clinical social worker. So as I've seen people from week to week talking about how powerful this is, and I've felt it myself, how powerful some of these experiences are when we meditate, I started to, this is also part of my personality, is I started to worry about people who are going through kind of intense experiences with maybe here by themselves or not having any support to deal with them. And I just wondered how you address that, whether there are people in this center that can help, you know, help people if they need support with those things.
Can you give me an example of an intense thing they're going through?
That I've gone through?
No, not you. No, oh. just I'm not quite sure.
I just remember 1 week somebody saying that they were finding themselves feeling very upset and irritable after they meditated, or not saying that that person was necessarily having intense experiences, but I know that it's brought up a lot of stuff in dreams for me, my husband too. We can talk to each other about it, but I just have been concerned about process it.
So now I think I understand what you're saying. So the issue is when you're meditating, sometimes it opens up doors in the mind and the heart that some difficult things come up. Like sometimes people keep things repressed, or they keep things at a distance. I don't want to look at that. And or they're so busy they don't really notice what's really bubbling up inside. And if they stop and calm down, lo and behold, they find out that they're angry or furious or there's some kind of trauma there. Sometimes it's quite severe. Friends of mine who teach mindfulness in the Oakland public schools, they go around and teach this. That's one of the issues that they have to be very sensitive to, is some of the kids there in the Oakland school system have very deep trauma. And, you know, they've seen people get shot and you know, there's been, you know, violence in their homes and a variety of things. And so if you get people to calm down, sometimes they touch that part that they've... So you have to be very careful and know how to handle it. Generally, an interclass like this, it doesn't open up Pandora's box. If anything, it gives people inner strength, so it's easier to be present for these things if they do come up. If it's really severe, then sometimes it's useful to get some help. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's good to go find a therapist to get the ongoing support. You know, occasionally I'll tell people that they should probably go start see a therapist because it's more of a psychological issue that's been highlighted. Mm-hmm. Here at IMC, there's a variety of ways of getting support here. But, you know, if it's a really deep psychological crisis, you know, it depends on the circumstances how much we're going to support here or how much we're available for that. But kind of for ongoing support, there's ways of coming, talking to me after my teaching and talk a little bit one-on-one at the end, and usually that takes care of a lot. We look at our schedule. We have all kinds of activities where there's opportunities to talk with someone. Mm-hmm. Coming up, I was going to announce it later, but Susan, who's sitting here, Susan Ezekiel, right up here in front, she is one of our, you know... most senior members here, and for many years now, she's been leading a follow-up for this intro class for the next 5 weeks after this. Is it on Tuesdays?
Actually, it's going to be Wednesday.
It's Wednesday. Starting next Wednesday?
Starting next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday.
I have some flyers here that I'll leave out.
Yeah, it's called the Beginner's Practice Group. And for those of you who are interested in following up this intro class and getting support, she has this wonderful program. It's... you do some meditation, she does some teaching, and there's a lot of chance to discussion and to talk about what's going on for you in a practical way, a useful way. And so some people, it's been very, very rich for the people who do it. And so that's a place to get some more support for something.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. So... as an introduction to doing our little meditation, I just want to review briefly. So the meditation that I've been teaching you is called mindfulness meditation. And it's a practice meditation of bringing careful attention to what's happening in the present moment as it's happening. And mostly it's very hard for the mind to do that because the mind either goes off into thoughts, into images, and gets pulled into its concerns and obsessions very, very easily. So the mind actually spends a lot of time in the past, in the future, in fantasy, and abstractions, anything but here in a full way. But if it is here in the present moment, then it's often being present, analyzing, interpreting, commenting, engaged in the present moment in ways that often are not so useful. It can be very judgmental, very afraid, caught up in an emotional reactivity and judgments about what's happening, interpreting what's going on, looking at what's happening through the filter of me, myself, and mine, my own self-preoccupation, perhaps. And it's very rare to actually be fully present and see things clearly without the colored glasses of emotions, commentary, interpretations, self-concept, beliefs, assumptions. And so the practice of mindfulness is to learn to be present and to be really present here. But to be present where there's some clarity, where we just see things as they are in their simplicity. That's kind of the goal. It's not easy to do. It takes time to do it. But we start doing something that's considered, in principle, very easy. And that is, we turn our attention to focus on the breathing. Our breathing is always in the present moment. And if you're connected, aware that you're breathing, you're in the present moment. Some people think, well, that's boring. It's only boring if there's a reaction, an evaluation, a judgment going on. It turns out the breathing is a wonderful place to cultivate and strengthen our capacity to be present and concentrated here and now. And if you give yourself over completely to just being with the breath, it tends to produce a lot of joy. Some meditation traditions talk about bliss arising from that simplicity of just letting the mind become simple and just being here really for that. In our tradition, that can happen, but we're focusing on using the breath to help as a guide us into the present moment, to stay connected, to cultivate the ability to be present, until such a point that something else becomes compelling, and we can bring a kind of a meditative awareness, a kind of a relaxed awareness, to notice clearly, oh, this is happening now. So if there's strong sensations in the body, you would turn your attention and be and have a meditative, a calm, present moment awareness of what's happening in the body. And trying not to judge it or change it or you know, have a reaction to it. Just let me just feel it. This is how it is. If there's a strong emotional reaction that's compelling, makes it difficult to stay with the breath, then we would turn our attention and do mindfulness of the emotion. Not to celebrate the emotion, not to repress it, but just to feel it and allow it to be there. And to really, in a way, to step back from it a little bit and look at it as opposed to being pushed around by it or being directed by it. But to really acknowledge, this is what's happening now. And it's really remarkable, the feeling, the kind of internal, psychophysical, spiritual kind of feeling that happens when you take your attention and allow yourself to settle into the present moment experience, the fullness of that experience, the fullness of your embodied experience, the fullness of your emotional experience. Most people don't give them a chance, give themselves a chance to do that because we're always so quick to react and want things to be different, try to manipulate, change, hold on to, judge, analyze, figure out what it means, and just relax into it. Sometimes, you know, maybe an analogy would be kind of like the feeling you have if you you kind of ease yourself into a nice hot bath and just kind of feel and enjoy the hot bath and let the hot bath kind of let your muscles kind of relax. There's something about being lowering or connecting your mindfulness to what's happening just as it is that can sometimes have that feeling, kind of a releasing, a softening. And then we should do the same thing with thinking. If thinking becomes predominant, then we let go of the breath and we just notice the phenomenon of thinking, again, without getting involved in the thinking. Just going to see it for what it is, as we talked about 2 weeks ago. If there's loud sounds around you when you're meditating, we don't take that as a distraction. We take it as something else to meditate on. And we do listening meditation, hearing. We just hear the sounds as they happen, taking them in. And when they're no longer compelling, we go back to the breath. So that's kind of the basic kind of approach. Make some sense? So what you heard, I hope. And then I want to give you an image for this, and it will be used perhaps during this next meditation. There's two ways of understanding this instruction. One is prescriptive, and one is descriptive. Prescriptive means this is what you do. You bring your attention to the breath, something else happens, you bring your attention to that, this is what you do. Another way is the descriptive way of understanding it, which is you don't do much at all, but you notice what arises. You sit there with your breath, and at some point you notice there's a sound. You don't go looking for the sound, you notice that it happens. After a while you notice that a sensation in your body has arisen. You don't do anything except take that in. So it's more receptive rather than actively doing and going to things. So the image is that of, that's used in Buddhism, is that of a one-room house. Imagine you have, you're in a one-room house. It has 5 windows and a door. And that's supposed to be kind of a symbolic for the human being, because there's supposed to be 6 senses in Buddhism, the 5 senses that we have, and the 6th sense, the door, is the mind, the sense door that can see what goes on inside our thinking and stuff. So there's this one-room house, and in the middle of the one-room house, there's an easy chair, very comfortable. And you sit in that easy chair, just sit down and relax. And you're there looking at, the door's open, the windows are open, it's a nice day. And then as you sit there, a cat walks by through the door. And you notice a cat walks by. Maybe the cat stops and looks at you and you look back and the cat leaves. Or a squirrel jumps up on the windowsill and runs out, or a bird flies by. So one approach would be to see the cat and then get up and go after the cat. To see the squirrel and go up to the squirrel and try to chase it away. To go see the bird and get your camera to take a picture. Or go out into the woods looking for it. You know, you kind of leave your seat. Another approach is you just sit back. And when something appears in the window, you acknowledge it. You see, that's what's happening. When something appears in the door, that's what's happening. But you don't leave your easy chair. You stay relaxed. If someone, you know, if a menacing looking neighborhood dog appears at the dog and growls, you stay in your easy chair and watch. Because you know it's not going to come in. So you just kind of, you say, oh, you know, look at that. It's a scary dog. It's scary. I'm scared. Scared. But you know, you don't leave your easy chair. So the idea as meditation, as you develop a meditation, it moves more from the active side of like you're doing something, more to this more receptive side, where you're actually doing less and less. And all you end up doing eventually is just noticing what's there, what has arisen. You don't have to do much at all. It's actually very, very simple. You're here to notice, and the full spectrum of what can happen in human experience is included. But you don't have to do anything except notice what arises. You don't have to have an expectation or looking for something special to happen. If I do this just right, then this great thing will happen. That's expectation. That's, you know, missing what's going on. But rather, just notice what is, what is. And then you might say to yourself, this can't be good enough. And then you see that in the door, having not good enough thoughts. Look at that. And that goes away, as opposed to go chasing after that thought. And if you do that, remarkable things begin showing themselves. Many of the animals in the forest are quite shy, some of the most beautiful ones. And if you go trashing around the woods, they won't show themselves. But if you sit in your easy chair, amazing things will come to you at the window. Make sense for an image? So, let's do some meditation. So even though we're using this image of an easy chair, I would encourage you to sit up straight. So gently close your eyes. And then before anything else now, just very generally check in with yourself. Notice here and now how you are. How are you in your body? How are you in your heart? How are you in your mind? What kind of concerns, activities going on for you? And for right now, having acknowledged how you are, let yourself be at ease with that. Perhaps you can ease up any worry, concerns about what it is, any judgments, and let yourself be present for how you are. Nothing wrong with how you are, nothing right. It is what it is, and you're just here for it. Be present. And then within the body, as part of your bodily experience, becoming aware of your breathing. Become aware of how your body experiences breathing. No need to judge your breathing or all we're doing is noticing what it's like for the body to be breathing. And then as a way of settling into the present more fully, it can be helpful to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. And then on the exhale, as you take a longer exhale, to relax your body. To exhale and settle in. Taking a deep breath in and feeling how the rib cage, the shoulders might expand and stretch. And as you exhale, letting the shoulders soften, shoulder blades relax. And then letting your breathing return to normal. Remember, it's always good to do little relaxation at the beginning. So perhaps you can soften your belly. Perhaps there's a softening that can be done in the legs. Perhaps a softening in your face. If you feel any tension anywhere and it doesn't soften, it's okay. Just soften around that. Be easy with it. So then feeling the experience of breathing, noticing how the inhalation is experienced differently than the exhalation, noticing what the difference is. And as you're sitting here, imagine that you're in an easy chair. Or there's an easy chair deep inside you from which you're aware. And different things occur, the different doors, windows, sound. Thoughts arise, more sound. Sensations in your body, experience of breathing comes and goes. Some things stay at a window or door for a long time, some fleetingly are there for a moment and pass. See if you can let your awareness be relaxed and receptive, alert enough that you don't drift off in thought, but receptive, noticing what arises, what occurs, letting it be as it is, Whatever occurs always stays at the window and door. There's no need to be worried that comes in if you stay aware. Notice what's happening from the inside. It might be helpful in staying present and just to very, very gently whisper in the mind to label your experience as you're aware of it. As you breathe in, be aware of in. Out, whisper out. If there's a sound, whisper very quietly, hearing. If there's a feeling, just note feeling. Or a thought, no thinking. And see if a quiet whisper, just very quietly labels the experience, helps you stay in your seat, relaxed, receptive, allowing things just arise as they do. If nothing is particularly compelling, stay with your breathing. Breathe in and breathing out. Letting go of whatever you're concerned about. If anything is happening that makes it difficult for you to be present, bring your attention to that. Include that in clear awareness, recognizing what it is. Generally, if something is difficult for meditation, it means that we're not really paying attention to it. So then to end this sitting, you can take a couple of deep breaths, feeling your body. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. I once heard as wonderful instructions from a yoga teacher. It was doing something like the triangle pose, where one arm is bent over and one arm is straight, and you're trying to touch the ground, but you can't touch the ground because you're too tight. So the instruction was to get a phone book to prop up your hand. So, you know, hopefully you're flexible enough, you can get down far enough to get, you know, your hand on the phone book, so it's a little bit off the ground. So that worked. So get support from the phone book. And then do that posture every day, and every day tear away one page from the phone book. And, you know, those pages are pretty thin. So, you know, you don't really notice the difference from day to day. But if you do it every day, it might take a couple of years. I don't know how big the phone book is. But eventually you get your hand all the way down to the floor. So, same thing with meditation. That by doing it every day, you might not see the changes. But there's something really remarkable that happens by the continuity of practice, doing it day after day after day. And there's those small changes that seem imperceptible from day to day make a big difference over a year, over 2 years, over a period of time. Even if people get a lot of benefit right away from meditation, or if they don't get any benefit right away, big benefits, the real value comes from the steadiness of doing it day in, day out. There's something that happens in discipline. It happens, something that happens and changes inside. It's like the human mind and heart is trainable. It's malleable. It can change and grow and develop and mature. And whatever you do regularly has a big impact on that maturation or the development or the growth or the direction that your mind and heart goes. If you spend every day watching angry movies, it's going to slowly, have an effect over time. If every day you do something that's generous and kind, it slowly changes you. If every day you focus on being present and calm in meditation, slowly, slowly, the whole system will kind of organize itself around that, will change and develop. And it's really remarkable what can happen over time. So one of the ways of developing this practice that I've been teaching you here is to do it regularly, to have a regular practice every day, and not measure from day to day how it's going, but just trust the continuity and how it develops and grows over time. Sometimes when people have done it for some length of time, say you do it every day for 6 months, or pretty much every day for 6 months, or maybe a year, I don't know how long you want to do it, say 6 months, then it's interesting to stop doing it for a few days. And then notice what the difference is. And often it's very instructive. And sometimes you don't see what a big benefit it brings your life until you stop doing it. Because it's kind of like those telephone pages, you don't see the slow change until you suddenly put, the full phone book back. So what I'd like to talk about for the remainder of the time is how to develop this practice further beyond the regularity of practice. And there's two primary ways to take this if you want to go further with it. One way is to couple the practice with concentration. And the other is to apply it and bring it to your daily life. So the first, to concentration. Concentration means mindfulness is the ability to be present and notice clearly what's going on as it's happening. Concentration is developing the mind's ability to be still and focused on what you're noticing. Sometimes concentration is likened to, or mindfulness is like looking out of looking at the moon on a clear sky night, and you can see it fine. But if you want to take a photograph of the moon, you better put your camera on a tripod. And then you have greater stability. So concentration puts the mindfulness on a real strong tripod, so it becomes more penetrating. You can see more deeply what's going on. And there's a number of ways of developing concentration. In our tradition, we primarily focus on letting the concentration develop by regularity of practice, practicing every day, but also by going on meditation retreats. There's something about not just doing it for 20 minutes a day, but doing it all day, or doing it for a weekend, or doing it for a week. And we have a lot of, our tradition puts big emphasis on meditation retreats, which are contemplative vacations, retreats, that where you step out of your normal life as you normally lived. And as you separate you out of your normal life, it allows the normal activities of the mind, the normal preoccupations, concerns, to settle away. And the meditation has a better chance of developing a more stable, concentrated way. And it's really remarkable what happens when you can meditate many days in a row. The retreats we do, you don't meditate nonstop. Usually the meditations are about 45 minutes at a time. And then there's 45 minutes of what's what we call walking meditation. And there's breaks and there's talks and instructions and various things that happen. But it's one of the ways of deepening the concentration is to go have an extended period of time to keep doing it. Just extended. So regularity of practice builds concentration, but then doing it over an extended period of time builds concentration. Another way of developing concentration, some people need it because the mind is so scattered. You know, if your mind is so agitated, you can't even, you know, after 20 minutes meditation, the bell goes off and where was I? You know, oh, I was supposed to be meditating. I was somewhere else. If it's really, mind is really agitated, then what we encourage people to do is to just do a concentration practice for a while. And the concentration practice is just stay with the breath. Don't let yourself focus on anything else. If anything else takes you away, come back to the breath, come back to the breath, come back to the breath. And develop some real steadiness and stability on with the breath, training the mind to let go of its other concerns. Some people find that very helpful. And then once you're more stable, then you can turn and include everything else in the awareness. You know, then you can turn towards a thinking mind and be mindful of it, rather than turning towards a thinking mind and become it. Be caught up in it. So, and then the other thing that can be helpful in terms of developing more concentrated, focused practice is to get support from other people. And it's often encouraged that it's good to meditate occasionally with other people. So like once a week or once a month or something. And, you know, there's so many different meditation groups around now. It's pretty easy to find. I mean, you're always welcome to come back to IMC. We have a kind of open door policy. Everyone's welcome to come and join us for our programs. We're somewhat casual, meaning that intentionally, so it's easy if you come and go. And we don't charge for anything, so it makes it easy as well. And but there's lots of, you know, other groups around you can go sit with. And if there's if you live someplace where there's no meditation groups, some people have had great success meditating with the Quakers. The friends' meeting houses on Sunday mornings, they sit in silence. And sometimes they speak, but they let you just sit there in silence. There's something about sitting with other people that's very supportive, by osmosis or by example or something. We learn something. Nothing else, we feel some encouragement. Sometimes it's you might be the only person in your circle of friends and colleagues who meditates. So it seems like you're the only oddball, you know, the only weirdo. And just to know that the other people who share this and value it can actually be very encouraging. Some people find that if they meditate on a regular basis, it begins changing some of their values. And some of the things that seemed okay to do in the past no longer seem okay, as we're more attentive and have a heightened sensitivity to what's going on. One of the common ones that I've seen around here, that people come back and say, you know, there's a lot of gossip in my place of work, and I no longer feel comfortable participating in it. And it comes directly out of kind of feeling more settled, calm, open, cleaner, kind of a cleaner feeling that comes from meditation. And it just doesn't seem right anymore to participate in that gossiping. But it's hard not to. I feel like I'm the odd person out, and, you know, what am I supposed to talk about? So sometimes by being around other people who meditate, you can at least feel like you're not, you know, so strange. There's some, at least other strange people too. You know, you don't feel so alone. But most of you don't seem strange. None of you seem strange, so. You know, you seem completely ordinary to me. So it's good to see that, right? Sometimes, you know, if you come, some places they have teachings like here, and sometimes it's useful to get the teachings. They kind of can be encouraging, and they can be challenging. And ideally, a teacher would be do both encourage you to keep practicing and challenge you at the same time to really, you know, to stretch yourself, to become a better person, to look more deeply at what's going on, to be honest and maybe face some of the things that are challenging in your life. So developing kind of, I call this coupling of the concentration, the focus, the be more focused at what you do, the regularity, retreats, sitting with other people. The other thing to do is to bring it into your... Oh, so before I do that. So as the mind gets more concentrated, The Buddhist tradition says that a concentrated mind becomes wise. That wisdom starts bubbling up. It's very interesting because most of we think of wisdom arising because we know something or we have some kind of great life experience that we understand or learn from or develop or something. But in Buddhism, they say that wisdom can also happen as in a natural way. It's a natural result of a mind that has a strong concentration. The mind is able to be still, focused, calm, steady mind. The mind is not pulled left and right. The mind is not reactive to what's going on, but it's learned to be still. That it gives birth to wisdom. And part of that is because as the mind is not caught up in its usual preoccupations, obsessions, interpretations, commentary, agitated kind of reactions to everything, it sees more clearly what actually is. And wisdom arises from the clear seeing. And one of the things we can see is how things are in their simplicity and all the extraneous judgments, reactions we add on top of it. And we add a tremendous amount on top of our life that's not needed. And it's the stuff we add on top that's often the source of our suffering. So I want to do a little example of this. So I have here a flower. There's a tradition, Buddhist teachers holding up flowers to teach various things. So I have here a flower. And it's, you know, a nice flower. And we say that if you look at the flower as it is, you see the thusness of the flower, the suchness of the flower, just a flower. So you see the flower, so, okay? So appreciate the flower. So the flower by itself. But now, if we do this and put this flower, so we have this large flower in my left hand and this teeny flower in my right hand. So now we can say something we couldn't say before. Now we can say this is the large flower and this is the small flower. Right? So that's interesting, right? Now watch as I do magic right in front of your eyes. And you can even see how the hands do. I'll do it slowly so you can watch. So remember, this is the large one and this is the small one, right? All agree, right? Large, right? So which one's large now? Now this new one, this is my right hand, it's quite a bit, it's a sunflower kind of thing. This is the large one, and this one is a small one. Large and small does not reside in the flower. It resides in the comparison, the thinking mind that compares them. The flower by itself is just the flower, the thusness, the suchness of the flower. The flower is just a flower. Now, that's easy to see with a flower, but it's harder to see in ourselves. And most of human suffering belongs to that world of comparative thinking. I'm not good enough. I'm better than someone else. My hair is too long. My hair is too short. I'm too tall. I'm too short. I'm too thin. I'm too fat. I'm too this. I'm too that. You know, I'm not, you know, whatever. We're constantly comparing ourselves to standards, to other people, to ideas, to who we were before, who we were after. There's all this comparative thinking going on. As the thinking mind, as the reactive mind calms down in meditation, and we stop adding all these extra layers of ideas of what should be and how we are and comparison and all that, and we start settling into what in Buddhism sometimes is called the suchness of ourselves, the thusness, just how we are in ourselves without any comparison. And in that world of suchness of who we are, there's no good you, no bad you. There's no, you know, wrong you, right you. There's just this. There's no right flower, wrong flower. You know, there's only wrong and right if you start comparing it to different things. But in and of itself, it's just what it is. And it's quite a remarkable thing to begin settling down and relaxing or letting go of all this extra baggage that we carry around with us, which is appropriate sometimes in life, but we get kind of stuck in that mode of always living in that world of comparative thinking. And meditation is one of the ways to let go of it. And as the mind gets still and focused and concentrated, then it's possible to leave things alone in their simplicity. Just this. So, it's one thing, you know, the flower is one thing, but it can be, for example, just the simplicity of your distress. Say you're feeling distressed around something. I'm just distressed. The suchness of distress. This is how it is. As opposed to, I shouldn't be distressed, this is terrible, I'm going to get in trouble if I stay distressed, they're going to be judging me if I'm distressed, you know. There's all we add, we're so quick to add all these, I'm a bad person because I'm distressed, or, you know, you can imagine all the layers and layers we add. What is it like just to be distressed? or happy, or sad, just as it is, in the simplicity of it. What is it like to let go of needing to be anything for anybody? Just to be who you are, just to be. You don't have to even be yourself, just to be. So as the mind gets stiller, more concentrated, more focused, it's no longer pulled into what's called the tides of conceiving. It's no longer pulled into the various streams of concerns, preoccupations, interpretations, reactions. And we start seeing things more clearly for what they are. And there we start seeing having wisdom. To be able to see that flower is just a flower, and see that the comparison is the comparison, that gives birth to wisdom. To be able to see yourself being sad, and seeing that your judgments around being sad, your way you make a self around it being sad, the way you compare yourself to others on being sad, all the ideas and judgments you have, I should get over it by now, that's all extra. What would it be like if I just be sad? I read a few times recently, maybe it's a new discovery, I don't know, but a remarkable claim coming out of psychological research. I don't know if it's even true, but I keep reading it in different journals and stuff, that left alone, any emotional response will last 90 seconds at the most. Isn't that remarkable? 90 seconds? What? I've been depressed for months. Am I the exception? What happens is that we don't leave it alone. We pick it up, we react to it, we get involved in it, we judge it, and we get pulled into its world. And so as we learn to step back and just be present and get out of its way, don't interfere, then the remarkable natural unfolding of things can occur. And things actually resolve, and evolve, change, and flux much quicker than you can possibly imagine if you learn to be really present. So that's the one side, just developing the practice, concentration, wisdom comes with it. So the other thing is developing the practice in daily life. And there's a number of reasons for this, to be mindful in daily life. One is that life tends to work better if you pay attention to it as it occurs. Just today, I guess a lot of people are saying these days, but I heard it on the radio today, someone mentioning about multitasking, that some people say they can multitask, but our memory is impaired. People don't remember what's going on. They don't very well. They don't actually see fully what's going on when they're doing more than one thing at a time. There's all these deleterious effects. Even though it seems like you may be doing a lot, the quality of the presence, the involvement, what you're doing is greatly diminished. And so so to actually really be mindful and be present for what you're doing while you're doing it, the one thing you're doing, not the 10 things, develops kind of many of our natural functionings of the mind and the heart can function much better in that kind of clarity. Also, if you're mindful in daily life, you'll see what's going on better. You'll see your reactions, your thoughts, your interpretations. You see what other people happening to other people, and you have a lot more information to guide you to know how to do what's wise. If you're mindful of the fact that the impulse to hit someone has just occurred, you know, maybe you won't hit them. If you're mindful of yourself wanting to say something that's not wise, you see it's about to happen, then maybe you won't say it. If you're mindful of the person that you're with, then maybe how you respond to the person will be sensitive to how the person actually is. It's so easy to not pay attention. I remember once, it was a big lesson to me, many years ago now. I was working at a restaurant as a cook, and it was the shift time, and I was getting ready to leave, And my friend was coming on his shift. And I think I was in a good mood or something. It was, you know, it was an innocent good mood. And my friend came into the changing room. And I didn't take the time to be mindful of him, to see him for who he was. And I made some kind of happy-go-lucky, silly kind of remark towards him. Only to find out very soon after that his best friend the day before had died. You know, and it was, you know, was, you know, if I'd just been taken 2 seconds, just kind of been mindful to read what he, how, you know, his demeanor, I would have seen, you know, this is not time for, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of teasing or something. So to be mindful and present, you know, life becomes richer, clearer. We can operate more clearly in life. More importantly, life tends not to become as stressful if we're mindful as we go along. Part of the reason we get what stress is in many people's daily life is the accumulation of stress that builds and builds and builds over time. And sometimes it's a lot of small little incidences of stress, small reactions that accumulate over time. Remember the telephone book, taking away the pages? And that, you know, sometimes the pages are added. You know, it's so innocent, you know, just a little bit of how I drive. It's, you know, it's stressful, sure, but, you know, it's nothing, you know, it's just hardly notice it. Maybe it's nothing, but and you have that, you know, when by lunchtime you've done some little pieces of stressful activity. Maybe you've done it 250 times, 500 times, and it accumulates. So you don't see how it builds, and pretty soon you're stressed out. So be mindful. You can actually, mindfulness helps you not be stressed, helps you relax and let go. But even more important, to be really mindful allows for the accumulation not to build. So some people find extremely helpful to start cultivating mindfulness in daily life, which means to simply recognize what's happening as it's happening. The other benefit of mindfulness in daily life is that it supports mindfulness in meditation. If you develop that habit of being mindful in daily life, then it's that habit continues and supports you in meditation. If you do meditation, it supports in daily life, and they work beautifully hand in hand. So there are various ways of developing greater mindfulness in daily life. One way is to choose, because it's hard. It's hard to say, well, I'm going to be mindful in my daily life, thank you. You know, just from now on. You know, that's a setup for not working. So sometimes it's good, if you're interested in this, to choose particular tasks to be like your mindfulness tasks. So it could be like whenever you drive your car, you're going to drive mindfully. You're going to leave the radio off, phone's turned off, you know, you're just going to drive the car. Maybe keep both hands on the steering wheel. Just be there fully for that experience. It's a gift to the rest of the world if you do that. and just kind of be really present for yourself, for what's going on, and explore what it's like to be fully present now. That's your kind of a mindfulness time. Chances are, if you drive with that kind of presence and mindfulness, stay present for what's going on as you drive, chances are you'll arrive where you're going much more relaxed than if you drive other ways. In fact, what I've noticed myself is that, you know, sometimes I like turning on the radio. It's a fine thing to do. But I've also noticed that if I drive for a long time with the radio on, as pleasant as it might be, and enjoyable as it might be, I'm actually arrive where I'm going much more relaxed if I leave the radio off. And the temptation of the pleasure is so like immediate gratification thing. You say, this is a good thing to do. But some of the benefits of mindfulness are, you know, delayed gratification. In the sense, if I don't go for that immediate pleasure, but just stay present for that half an hour drive, at the end, I actually find myself much more settled, composed, concentrated, attentive than I've always, I was listening to the radio. At least that's for me. Maybe it's different for other people. So particular tasks. Some people will choose dishwashing. You know, if you're washing dishes at home, that's a time when you don't talk, you don't have the radio on, television on, just do the dishes and, you know, explore what it's like to do it that way. Some people like to do the telephone ringing. I don't know for you, but I have this little strange compulsion, I don't know where it comes from, that it's desperately important to answer the telephone at the least number of rings. I don't know what's going to happen. The world's going to fall apart, or I don't know, if I don't get there quickly. But most people don't hang up after, you know, three or four rings. They let it ring for a while. So I find it very interesting not to answer the phone immediately, but to just let it ring for a couple of rings and use that time as, I use it as a mindfulness bell. Okay, let's check in, find out what's going on, what's happening here. Breathe, find out with my breathing, check in with myself, find out. And I find that if I do that, and I know I've really checked in with myself, know where I am, I'm usually much more present in a wiser way for the phone call than if I just answered it quickly, like one thing, and you know, running, doing many different things. So some people, you know, choose, you know, the one thing they do to be mindful through the day is that. Some people choose, like if you have to walk from your car, maybe where you park it, to work, to do that as a walking meditation. And the handout today talks about walking meditation, which is a big part of form of meditation in our tradition. So to walk mindfully from, you know, through the parking lot, as opposed to, you know, business as usual. I know some people have put stickers on all the light fixtures, all the light knobs, light switches in their house, so that every time they go to flip a switch, they're reminded, pay attention. You know, what's happening now for you? In the Zen world, in Zen monasteries, I learned a wonderful trick in practice. And every time I walk through a door frame, to be mindful. So the door frame is my reminder, be mindful now. And you're going into a new space, so it makes some sense to pay attention. But so to notice, you know, how am I, what's happening around me, just be mindful of what is. So by choosing particular tasks, and maybe over time, different tasks, you start developing a familiarity with that, being mindful in that task. And maybe you start discovering the advantages of being mindful in that task, so you want to do it some more. And slowly, over time, over a year or some years, you begin bringing more and more mindfulness into more and more activities of your daily life. Life gets a lot richer when you do that. So those are some of my thoughts. I thought that now I'd like to hear from you. Do you have any comments about any of this, or questions, or so straight back there? If you wait for the mic, please.
Wherever it is.
It's right there.
Make sure the green light is on.
Do you have any suggestions on staying mindful when you have two small children? And, you know, your 24-hour-a-day life is surrounded by other people and not a lot of alone time.
Yeah. there's a lot to be said about that. One is to have enough mindfulness to know what's happening for you, and not to lose touch with yourself. So know what your needs are, and know what what's bubbling up inside of you, so that you can take care of yourself. At least you know what's going on for you, so that you're less liable to act inappropriately. Like if you're getting frustrated, you know, not having enough alone time. If you're really cognizant of the fact, I'm frustrated, then maybe you're less likely to lash out. So just check in, just know where you are, check in with yourself as off. It doesn't take long to check in. The door frame, you have to go through the door. There's a wonderful story. There's one of the great teachers in our tradition is a woman named Kamala Masters. And tells this story. She had four kids, right? Four kids. And she was a single mom. And somehow or other, I don't know how it happened, but she was able to go on a meditation retreat with an Indian meditation teacher in our tradition. And the end of the retreat, the teacher said, it's really important that every day you should meditate for an hour. And she had enough presence of mind to go up to him and said, no way. I can't do that. And he said, of course you can. Everyone can do that. You just have to change your priorities and you should be able to do it. So she had enough presence of mind or wisdom or something. She said, she invited him to come and live with her for a while. And so he came. And I don't know how long it took, but after a short time, he said to her, "You're right." And so what is, what I'll do is I'll teach you how to be mindful in your daily activities instead. And so he would be with her at the sink as she was washing dishes and show her how to be mindful washing dishes. And there was a hallway in her house that connected all the rooms. And he said, because you have to walk through this hallway so many times through the day, this hallway becomes your meditation center, your meditation hall. And do walking meditation as you go through. You just check in, know what's going on. And she kind of continued doing all the things she had to do without doing meditation, but she did it mindfully. And she developed tremendously in her spiritual life this way. And then at some point, her kids were old enough, she was able to go on a retreat again. And she was kind of a star student because she dropped to deep meditation very quickly because of all the work she had done. So, there's always little opportunities, you know. If nothing else, when you're on the potty, they let you do that, right? Sometimes they don't let you take a shower, but they will let you go on the potty. You know, you sit there and breathe for two breaths, it takes a lot of small moments to add up over time. Now, having said all that, another thing that's very, very helpful in this situation and other situations is stay connected to your body. One of the most useful ways of developing mindfulness is to be mindful through your body, to know, feel your body, experience your body, know what's happening in your body as you go through it. Know what's happening with your posture, know what's happening with the tension in your body, the holding patterns, the feeling sensations in your body. If you're in touch with your body, you're mindful. You're present. And then if you can get a break, that helps a lot too. There's going to be apparently the movement afoot to have a parents program here at IMC. You know, that discussion, variety of things, teachings for parents. And the problem is that how do you get away? Someone else? Any questions about what I've said today or said over these weeks? Was it either so clear or was it so mystifying? And then I'll give you a Buddhist teaching then, since you Buddhism has some certain amount of focus on karma. You know, and making good karma. It's a whole story in itself. I don't want to get into the story of karma. But, you know, good karma is a good thing, right? So Buddhism teaches you make really good karma for yourself if you ask questions.
You need some good karma.
I didn't want to be negative. If I'm not paying attention, I can stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning and wake up at 6 and run around all day and do things and go out and not notice and not mind. And
what's the cost of doing that?
I don't know, because when I stop and sit here for even 5 minutes, all of a sudden I feel exhausted, sad. I mean, there's...
Yes.
It's a whole lot less fun to be mindful.
That's right. It can be that way. And so you have to decide what the cost is of one way. And I would encourage you to run the experiment and try being mindful for a while and slow down. Because it's very easy to live a superficial life. It's very easy to run away from oneself and to not really be in touch with what's happening. And the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of excitement, the pursuit of doing things and accomplishing things and staying busy is a substitute for some people from really feeling the depth of who they are. And sometimes there's good reason to avoid the depth because there can be a lot of suffering there. And but it's healable. It can be healed. Our beauty is down there as well. Our capacity for love and joy is there as well. And some people confuse the energy of doing a lot, the pleasure of doing a lot, for deep, abiding happiness and well-being and love. And the deepest forms of well-being happen when we're really deeply and fully in touch with ourselves. And if you're running around, it's, chances are you're not. And the cost, and for some people, what's required is to go through a period of great challenge to be able to drop into that deeper place, to become whole again. You know, in spiritual circles, they talk about the dark night of the soul. You know, so it's not this is not necessarily an easy path to go on. It's a beautiful path. It's a noble path. It's a great dignity. It's a beautiful thing to come into the depth of who we are, the fullness of who we are, to really stop and let the inner life, kind of the inner spiritual life, kind of bloom. But it's not a, it's not like going from, good to better. We have to really face ourselves, and sometimes we have to face the darkest parts of our lives. So it's really worth it, I think.
How do you practice mindfulness, let's say, when you have a backache?
Oh, that's a good one. Did I tell you? Maybe I didn't tell you the story of a friend of mine who was teaching mindfulness for pain, to help people with pain. Did I tell you the story of the police officer who came? And he was a retired police officer who was a really tough guy. And he tried everything to deal with his back pain. And nothing worked. So finally he came to this mindfulness class. His doctor sent him. And my friend told him, who was teaching it, said, turn your attention and feel the pain. And the man got really angry. I'm here to get rid of the pain, not to feel it. So one of the things we do, mindfulness can have a number of functions with any kind of pain, psychological pain, physical pain. One is it can help us understand what our relationship to the pain is. Because sometimes the pain is a lot worse because we're not stay with the suchness of the pain, but we have fear around the pain, we have anger towards the pain, we have self-pity in relationship to the pain, we contract around the pain. There's all this extra stuff we add to it. And a common phenomenon, I don't think it's just hearsay, is people having some kind of serious physical injury or something, or pain, and then as soon as you go to the doctor and get the diagnosis, it feels better. You know what it is. That pain has a huge psychological component to it. And so to assume that all pain is only physical is a mistake. So if you start looking at your relationship to the pain, sometimes you can then ease up on it and be much more easy about it, more relaxed around it. It can be very helpful. It doesn't make the pain go away, but it doesn't make such a big deal. I remember once driving down 101 many years ago. It was late at night and I had a terrible, terrible headache. I just couldn't believe how bad it was. And I was driving down, and I felt like I was going to throw up. It was so painful. And I had so much self-pity. Oh, poor Gail. Oh, it's so hard. And after a while, it dawned on me, I'm a meditation teacher. I'm a mindfulness teacher. I should be mindful. And so I started being mindful and just feeling the pain, being with the pain, just experiencing the pain. It was a lot easier. It was a lot easier than having self-pity, boy. And it wasn't so bad, actually, when I really just allowed myself to feel it and just be with it. And then I was okay to drive. And then after a while, I was, okay, this is good. And then I lowered my guard. And when I lowered my guard, the headache didn't go away, but when I lowered my guard, then this self-pity started to creep in. And then I was kind of pulled down, oh, poor girl. This is so hard. And oh, remember, mindful. Mindful, just be with it, let's feel it. So that's one thing. One way mindfulness can help is start noticing our relationship to our reaction to it. The other way that mindfulness can help is that something like back pain, if you're really attentive in a careful way, you might see that how you hold yourself, how you walk, how you sit, what you do, is maybe, it's a difference between how to move in a way that makes it a teeny bit better and how to move that makes it worse. If you're not mindful of the subtle distinctions, subtle nuances of how we move, you might not be able to start moving in more efficient ways, less ways that work better for you. I've had a bad back, a very bad back a few times, and I was so glad for mindfulness because, well, I had no choice but be mindful. Because if I wasn't acutely mindful, I felt like the back would break. I mean, just really, really, you know. And so I had to be very careful. But even short of that level of back pain, you know, you can actually start, with a lot of mindfulness, you can start kind of discerning, noticing, oh, if I walk that way, that doesn't help so much. Walk that way, that helps. And if I walk, change a little bit more, it helps more. So that can help. The other thing is that mindfulness can do is you can bring your mindfulness and really feel the pain in its simplicity. And there's something about just feeling pain without reacting to it, without tightening around it, contracting, resisting it, attacking it, just letting it be there. It's kind of like making space for the pain. And the pain begins to change a little bit or show itself differently. And interesting things start happening to pain when we just feel it there as it is. Sometimes it begins to unknot and unravel and move out. Sometimes it begins breaking up and it's not so solid. And you realize the solidity of pain has a lot to do with looking at it from a distance, looking at it through our fear or our anger. But if you relax and feel the pain really close up, then you say it's not so solid. It's actually made up of a lot of different sensations that are moving around and changing and rising and passing. And it seems to be, and sometimes pain begins to break up and soften a lot. And maybe part of the reason, I don't know if it's true, but part of the reason is you bring careful attention, relaxed attention to feel it. Maybe blood flows to that area, and maybe it begins to kind of form up or relax or something. I don't know. But it often... So those are some of the benefits of bringing mindfulness to pain. And it's, you know, I say that if you feel pain when you're meditating, you can always change your posture, of course. But there's also an opportunity to use meditation as a laboratory to explore your relationship to pain, to see all the extra reactivity that you have and learn how not to give into it, not to pick it up, not to get involved in it. And whereas in meditation you have a choice, so it would be easier to stay a little bit longer and explore and learn how to let go and not be so reactive or so pushed around by pain, so caught up in your thoughts and your actions and all that. But to learn to be free, now it's interesting, it's possible to be in bliss, to have very, very joyful states of being while you're experiencing intense pain. Pain does not mean that you have to have a painful mind, you know, suffering mind. So if you can learn how to be present for pain in meditation in a way that you're very relaxed, open, soft, it's okay, then someday in your life you're going to experience some intense pain that you can't get away from. And now and then you know the territory, you've learned about it, and you're able to kind of keep your cool, keep your balance, keep your wisdom operating. So that was a long answer, but hopefully that has some meaning. Mindfulness is used for managing pain. It's in clinical settings these days, so it's... You can read the books by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Jon Kabat-Zinn has a wonderful book called The Full Catastrophe Living, which is basically a clinical approach to using mindfulness for pain. Okay. Other concerns, questions? Yes?
I wanted to know your thought on using beads when you're meditating. A friend of mine said that that might be very calming. And I relate that to like praying the rosary in the Catholic religion. What are your thoughts on using beads?
It depends on what you want to do. If what you want to do is to calm down, and that helps, great, go for it. And sometimes we tend to think in Buddhism, say in Buddhism, is that using the rosary, but Buddhists have rosaries too, it's called a mala, is a concentration technique. It keeps us present, you know, so it could be helpful. But what we're, so yes, if it's helpful for you, please. But sooner or later, we encourage people to stop using any props. No, don't use guided meditation tapes, don't use music, don't use beads. Just do it on your own so that you really face yourself and you really develop the strength inside that you can do it without relying on anything else. But in the short term, if that's helpful to get you started, please. Yes, in the back.
This is just a simple question about your breath. I find when I'm maybe a third of the way into my session that I'm not just breathing in and out, but I have an inhale and an exhale and then a catch. And there's a period of time where it seems as if I'm without breath.
Great. Good. Yes.
And that is pretty much continuous, and it seems to get longer and longer into that third step.
That's very common as people get calmer. As the deeper the calm and the concentration is, the breath slows down, and sometimes there's a long pause, generally at the end of the out-breath. Sometimes it could be at the end of the in-breath, sometimes in both. And it's very interesting. So it's fine. I would just enjoy it and appreciate it. It's a good sign. However, what happens is that when there's a long pause, and you're not paying attention to the breath anymore because there's no breath to pay attention to, it's kind of like you're idle, mm-hmm. and idle mind will get in trouble. It's a gap where the mind starts thinking. And no, not for you?
No.
Well, so then don't worry about it.
Okay.
And so just be sure to stay attentive to be there for the beginning of the in-breath. And just stay there and just wait for the in-breath to begin. And just let it be that way. The instruction in our tradition is a little bit different. So I'll give you that so you know what it is and you can decide what's helpful. Experiment. So stay with the in-breath, stay with the out-breath, and then during that gap, don't focus on nothing, because that's not so, you always want to focus on something. And so focus on what's called the touch points. So where your hands are touching each other, or if you're sitting on the floor where the knees are touching the floor, or the feet are touching the floor, some place where there's contact. And just kind of, in a very relaxed way, you're breathing in, breathing out, feeling this knee touch, feeling that knee touch, then back to the in-breath. Some people do the lips touching, just breathing in, breathing out, feeling the contact. So you're always in touch with something. So you're seeing something rather than seeing nothing. So you can experiment and see which one is nice for you.
Thank you.
So last one. And there's a right.
I was wondering about visualization and whether that can or does not work with the sort of mindfulness meditation that we've been talking about. I've done guided visualized meditation, particularly along with doing yoga.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference between that and mindfulness meditation, or if there can be a confluence with the two.
Yeah, guided visualizations or visualization can be great things to do, very concentrating, and they have all kinds of benefits. Generally, we see them as different than mindfulness. So we don't want to confuse the two. Mindfulness has to do about seeing things directly, being present for things directly as they are. A visualization is kind of like an abstraction. And so we in our tradition, we call it, we kind of put it in the same category as a thought. So we don't want to think about things. We want to experience them directly. So, for example, some years ago, I was working with someone, and he had some kind of tension in his shoulders. And I asked him what it felt like. And he said, it feels like having heavy football shoulder pads on my shoulders. And I pointed out, well, that's just an image that keeps you separate from the experience. What are you actually experiencing that produces that image? Oh, there's a lot of heaviness and a lot of tightness. So if you see the football pads, you don't really see directly what's there, but if you feel what's there. But if you feel the tightness and the heaviness, then you're feeling directly what's there. So a visualization might get you calm, but it doesn't help you to see directly what's happening here and now. And that's the goal of mindfulness, is the simplicity of really connecting to here and now, what's actually happening. And because so many people need to relax and get calm, many people are confuse mindfulness with meditations that are only purposes calm. This can make you calm, but it's best to keep at the forefront what we're doing here is developing a clear seeing into what's actually happening here and now. And so visualization gets in the way of that. Okay, so a couple of things to end. So if you have any questions, more questions, you can come and ask me, or you can ask Susan, who's sitting here. She's been doing this for a long time, teaching this for a long time. And she has this wonderful beginner's practice group that starting next Wednesday for the following 5 weeks.
It's going to be next Wednesday, and then the following Wednesday is the one before Thanksgiving, so we won't have a class that night. And then it's three more Wednesday evenings, December 1st, 8th, and 15th.
So it's a way of getting some more support if you want that, to continue with this and kind of get more kind of momentum going. And then if you get our newsletter, I don't know if I said this at the beginning, I have this book that's called The Issue at Hand. It's available for free. You're welcome to take it. It has essays about this practice. It's on the counter somewhere. And in our newsletter, we have an extensive list of our programs, our schedule here. And you're always welcome to come back. Not only are you welcome to come back, but since we have no membership at all, you're welcome to consider yourself a member if you'd like. And if this is the kind of place you'd never want to be a member of, that's okay too. And please feel free to come as you'd like. And we do have that donation box by the door, which supports us and supports the people who teach here, like myself. So we're always very grateful for the support that's given. And I hope this course has been useful for you, and it'd be nice to see you again sometime. Thank you.